Welcome to Charlotte Readers Podcast, where authors give voice to their written words. This is the show where we meet Charlotte area authors and those who visit the Queen City, and we hear them read their work. This is Season 2, sponsored by Park Road Books, the oldest and only independent bookstore in Charlotte. I don't know about you, but I get a good feeling when I'm surrounded by a world of new books, and an even better feeling when I know I'm supporting the local independent bookstore. Consider stopping by Park Road Books for your feel-good experience. You'll meet a friendly staff ready to recommend that next great read, just for you. Speaking of feeling good, I've got a good feeling that you will enjoy our guest author today. So let's get to it. I'm your host, Landis Wade. Thank you for listening. In this episode, we spend time with author Ann Campanella, twice recipient of the Poet Laureate Award from the North Carolina Poets Society. Ann reads a poem called How to Grieve, and then follows this poem with readings from and discussion about her award-winning memoir, Motherhood, Lost and Found. Ann's memoir reveals the emotional journey she took with a mother who suffered from Alzheimer's, while at the same time dealing with the difficulty of having a baby given her predisposition to miscarriage. This truly is a story about motherhood, lost and found. Ann finishes with a poem about Hurricane Donna, a connection to her distant past. But first we hear Ann read, How to Grieve.
How to Grieve. Find a pasture where an old horse grazes. Open the gate and walk to a far corner of the field. Lie down in the weeds. Let your skin go hot, then cold. The horse will eye you warily. He might even run the other way. Don't look at him. Just lie there like a corpse, waiting for the dirt to be thrown. When you begin to itch and your hair feels alive, sit up and cross your legs. Keep your head down. Study the crosshatch of grass beside your ankle, the tiny black bugs that float and land on your hands. When you glance up, the horse will be standing like a statue, neck raised, ears pricked. He will step toward you and stop. Don't move or call to him. Simply sense the curve of his haunches, the sturdy plant of his hooves. Take the carrot from your pocket. Caress its damp shape. Snap it in two if you want. The horse, a hesitant, eager bundle of muscle, will step forward and stop. Step forward and stop. You will see that this is your life. If you wait there long enough, his long nose and thick barrel will approach. He will wipe your hand clean with his tongue. He will drink long from the bucket of water beside you, then tickle your face with the wiry hair of his muzzle, leaving patches of drool on your shirt, sticky and wet as tears. When you make a sudden move, he will shy sideways, the crest of his mane rising. He will turn and run, flinging gravel and dirt behind him. Don't watch. You will feel nothing but the rumble of earth and the wind of his leaving. Tomorrow, the horse will be small on the horizon, the pasture where you sit, empty and wide.
Ann Campanella is a former magazine and newspaper journalist, the author of four collections of poetry, and twice recipient of the Poet Laureate Award from the North Carolina Poetry Society. One of Ann's passions is spreading awareness about Alzheimer's disease. She is open and honest in discussing the difficulties and strategies in caring for a loved one with this terrible disease. Her Motherhood, Lost and Found was named one of the best Alzheimer's books of all time by Book Authority. She also was recognized by the Herald Citizen as one of the most influential women in her community for her work with Alzheimer's. And she's a member of the management team of allsauthors.com, a website that represents over 170 authors of books about Alzheimer's and dementia. Ann lives near her alma mater, Davidson College, on a small farm with her family and animals. Ann, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Landis. It's a treat to be here.
Yeah. The piece you read at the top of the show, How to Grieve, won the Poet Laureate Award from the North Carolina Poet Society and was published in a collection of poems. What were you grieving about when you wrote this?
I was grieving about my father. He had passed away a few months before this, and actually I had been a prolific journaler and writer of poetry, and for a period of time I just couldn't write a word. And this was the poem that came out a few months later after his death. I went down to the barn and just sat, and I basically wrote what happened. I kind of felt like it was one of those times when the words came to me. They were just poured into me from another source.
Your muse took over.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I was so glad, because I thought, am I never going to write again?
How long did you have? What kind of gap did you have there?
I would say it was about 3 months, and I really felt just numb. And I think my father had been such a huge presence in my life that I just was stunned to have him suddenly gone. My mother had been ill for years with Alzheimer's, and our family had focused so much on her that when he passed away, even though he was 80 and not in great health, nobody was prepared for it, and probably me most of all, because I was kind of the apple of his eye. Mm-hmm. And when he was suddenly gone, it was just like my rudder had departed, and there was nothing left.
Well, it's a beautiful piece. You can get the image here of the horse standing, neck raised, ears pricked. I hadn't ridden horses much. Went to Mexico one time, rode horses on a 50,000-acre ranch one time.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun trying to stay on.
I bet.
But you've got this, you got it down. He steps up, stops. You sense the curve of his haunches, the sturdy plant of his hooves. So you found some solace in horses, and you still do.
Yes, and it's interesting. I hadn't thought about this until you said this, but my father was the first person who really introduced horses into my life. When I was 9 years old, he lured me down to the Panama Canal Zone where we were moving with the promise of a pony. And of course I said, okay.
How to get one to move to Panama. Right?
Yes, yes. So horses represent not only the natural world, which is so important to me, but that connection to my father on some kind of deep level that I don't think I even realized.
And you live on a farm, right?
Yes.
You have horses?
Yeah. I have horses. At the moment, they are actually being boarded.
That's a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. And I've had horses on the farm for many years.
And you talk about that in your memoir that we're going to get to. Yeah,
yes. Yeah. Yes.
How much of you can't really handle a horse and someone who's going through an illness at the same time.
It's a lot to juggle. Yeah.
Timing of this was before you wrote your memoir that we're going to talk about.
It was probably in the midst of it. I actually had a draft of the memoir back. I think the first draft was in 1999, the first completed draft. And then it did take a number of years before I felt like I was ready to let it go out into the world.
Now, we've talked with other guests on the show about writing memoir, and they come at it from different perspectives in terms of whether it's hard or easy, whether it allows them to get some things out that they could, that they had bottled up or not. How was the experience for you?
Wow. I would say it was sort of a natural process. I'm a poet also, and I have always started with poetry, but poetry sort of encapsulates the emotion for me. And then I've always been a journaler, and so I would take maybe memories or scenes that were in my life and just expand them through journaling. And so that was kind of how the memoir came about. I was in the beginning visiting my parents as my mother's Alzheimer's was progressing. And each time I would come home from a visit, I would just pour out everything that happened. And at the same time, I would be writing poems about it to get to the emotional resonance. And then I was so just captured by kind of the joy of writing. I could recreate an experience that was really painful. And because I love writing so much, joy would kind of pour into that process. And so that was just an interesting kind of chemistry that would happen.
So when you read this book, and I read it, I thought that you were really in the moment throughout the book. And I was trying to think, how do you do that? How do you remember all these things that happened, the dialogue, you know, the setting? Were you writing it kind of as you went, or was a lot of this, you just have a very good memory and you can put it together?
Both. Okay. I was writing it as I went. I was journaling every day, just as much as I could, so I would capture the scene so I could return to it in my mind. And then as I was going through the editing process, there was a lot of, I call it creative nonfiction. Mm-hmm. I did have to recreate scenes, and all the conversations were generally what happened, but I was putting words in there that weren't necessarily all exactly accurate. So that was kind of the process.
Talk about that term a minute. I went to a writing seminar once on creative nonfiction. I'm trying to get my head around this term because it's supposed to be as true as it can be. And yet, to bring it to life, you've got to sort of inject your best memory, right?
Yes, yes. And I know some people struggle with it. For me, most memoir, I feel like, is creative nonfiction because you've got to add your creativity to whatever it is you're working on. I mean, I would take scenes and then sort of string them together, not necessarily in a way that followed the time sequence, but in a way that made sense for the book, and using metaphor to highlight some of the emotions that were going on. So it definitely, it was real life scenes, but I was using as much creativity to bring the beauty to the scenes as possible, as much as possible.
All right, we're going to bring it to life for our listeners here. We're going to start out, the title of the book is Motherhood, Lost and Found, a memoir. It reached a number one bestseller on Amazon, named one of the best Alzheimer's books of all time by Book Authority. This book has taken you out into the Alzheimer's community sort of as an advocate for caring for those with Alzheimer's.
It has. I never dreamed it would take me so deep into that world. A part of me, after writing it and living this experience, was like, okay, I'm done with that. Let me move on. But the gift of it really has been that it's returned me to a place where I can touch others who are also caregivers.
Okay, and we'll talk more about Alzheimer's and the community in a moment, but let's start out with this scene. Read it. We'll talk about it.
Okay. Time seems different to Mom and Daddy these days. They used to be satisfied and happy if I visited two or three times a year. Now, if I haven't seen them for even a few weeks, they feel as if they've been forgotten. Daddy introduces Joel to the waitress, saying, "This is my son-in-law, who hardly ever comes to visit." I flinch inwardly. Joel says, "Oh, Wint, that hurts." During the weekend, I learned that Daddy took away Mom's car keys after she started getting lost when she drove to the grocery store. It's the same store she's been to for years. He says she'd sit in the car and fiddle with the knobs. If he was outside, she'd roll down the window and ask him, "Why do they make these damn things so confusing?" Saturday morning, Mom walks behind the couch in the living room. From the waist up, she looks normal. She's wearing her white shirt with gold buttons and has carefully chosen a strand of pearls to wear around her neck. But when she passes the couch, I see that she has forgotten to put on her pants. I have to look twice. I'm too stunned to do or say anything. My father calls her back from the door when she tries to leave the house. She argues with him, then suddenly looks down at her bare legs, ashamed. Later, Daddy picks up hamburgers at Hardee's. He follows Mom around with the bag until he can get her to eat. They walk around a table half set with folded napkins, empty water glasses, and no plates. Mom hovers in the kitchen, moving back and forth between the stove and the table, as if she is checking on the progress of one of her dinners. Only there's nothing in the oven. All weekend, Mom searches for her notebooks and appointment calendars, the ones she can't read when she finds them. I wonder how the house feels to her as she wanders around it, day after day, darkness creeping around the corners. I'd like to ask her, but when I do, she gets upset. Her mouth forms a thin line that crumples, her face falling. She says my father has stolen something from her. She fluctuates from childlike and aggressive to her gentle, wise self, intent on doing the best for her children. One moment she is furious with my father, or sure someone is having a party without her. Then she throws out a statement like, "Now we don't want you all worrying about us." Her voice changes from hard and cold to warm and soft as fur in an instant. For someone like me who likes to categorize things, it's hard to get a handle on what is happening, who she is. I don't know where to begin. When I'm convinced she's over the edge and needs constant supervision, she turns back into my mother, her voice smooth, soothing all my rough edges.
And you've really covered a range of emotions in this segment that you've read here that affects those with dementia and Alzheimer's. I just made a list in my head here. You've got shame, anxiety, suspicion, anger, the fluctuation back and forth between all of those, and then out of nowhere emerges the compassion, and then at the end the hope. It's kind of a roller coaster, isn't it?
It truly is. Yeah. The emotions, that was what just got to me so much, living through that experience. Seeing my mom going through so many things that she didn't understand, and she's a very sensitive person, and I'm sensitive also, and that was part of why I had to journal just every day and multiple times a day sometimes to try to get out all the things that I was feeling, because I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, my sweet mother is just all over the place. And, you know, how does she do this? How can she cling to life in the midst of this craziness that's happening inside her? And we didn't know at the time that she had Alzheimer's. We just, because we were not a family that had talked about Alzheimer's, Mom was not really open about what was happening to her. And I felt like I was just in the dark and thought, maybe she's depressed, or just, you know, maybe my father's not giving her enough attention, or maybe I can do something to fix it.
So what you described there were emotions, not just that you're observing in your mother, but that you were feeling yourself.
Right? Yes.
So we've got the emotions that the person who's experiencing the Alzheimer or the dementia is going through, but then the family members are having this range of emotions as well.
Yes.
So how did you and your family cope with this?
Wow. We struggled. We have a very close-knit family, and I have to say, I don't think we could have gotten through it without the support. My siblings were incredibly supportive. My father was solid. He got mad at my mother a lot, but he was there, and he was willing to just do whatever it took. But it was not easy, and particularly because we really didn't know what we were dealing with. We were just sort of thrown into this Alzheimer's pond and trying to swim. And now I feel like I know so much more because I'm involved in so many Alzheimer's organizations and things like that. But if I'd had just a little bit of that information, it would have been so much easier.
Talk about the resources that are out there for families that...
Well, one organization that I did get some great information from was the Alzheimer's Association, and they just have incredible resources and basic information for anybody who's going through this. But I have to say that the resource that I'm most connected to is All's Authors, which is a relatively new resource. I guess it's been around about 2.5 years, and it is a website that has books and blogs, over 160 authors, books and blogs about Alzheimer's and dementia. And for myself, I was looking for memoir. I wanted somebody's experience. I didn't necessarily need a caregiving guide because I got that information from different places. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to know, how does somebody survive this? How do they live through it and actually thrive? And do people even come out on the other side alive? Because life just felt like it was suddenly so crazy and chaotic, and I didn't know what was going to happen next, that looking for books like that that would tell a story and uplift me, that's where I was. And so allsauthors.com
okay, great.
Is one of those.
Have you found that people who've read your book, have they given you feedback about how it's helped them in their own life struggles?
I have, and I've just been so touched. I have many, many just beautiful, heart-wrenching reviews that have been written on Amazon, and people have written letters to me and contacted me directly and just said, you know, your book helped me get through, you know, my own parents' experience or my own loss. And in some people, it wasn't even dementia or Alzheimer's, but some kind of loss. They just felt like it helped them move through it. And so that's been a gift.
And what do you think it is about your book? Can you step back and look at it objectively and try to sort of figure out why your experience is helpful to others?
That's hard, because I can look at other people's books and do that for my own. I mean, I'll say what I've tried to do is not preach to anyone, but just share the ups and downs that I was going through and be as authentic as possible in that. And so maybe they feel like they're getting a true story and kind of the experience of somebody who is not trying to hide all the hard parts. I mean, I've got things in there about my husband and I struggling and, you know, not, I didn't want to hurt anyone in anything that I included, but I did want to give the real story that, you know, this was not an easy journey.
I suppose dealing with a relative who's got Alzheimer's or dementia, it can be an isolating experience. And so perhaps reading what someone else has written helps them connect to a larger world.
Yes, that is so true, Landis. Mm-hmm. In fact, my mother had Alzheimer's for 14 years, and I felt completely alone in that journey. I did have a few friends who mm-hmm. knew what was going on, but the fact that nobody that I knew, because I was only 33 when my mother's Alzheimer's started showing up, my friends were busy dropping their kids off at preschool, and you know, they just had totally different lives and different perspectives. So I think that is one of the gifts of these kinds of books, that they can mm-hmm. help people know they're not alone.
And we're going to come back to a scene later in the book where you and your mother connect on a different level. But before we do that, this book has another theme to it. As I said, it's motherhood lost and motherhood found.
Yes.
And so let's have you, I'm going to read a little segment here from the found part of this.
Okay. A cold front moves across the Piedmont of North Carolina. The wind lifts my horse's mane from his neck, causing us both to shiver. He stands like a statue as I mount. His ears are alert, catching the sound of stray leaves being stripped from trees. The sky is clear, but the sun feels farther away than usual. In another hour, darkness will fall, and frigid air will sweep across the fields. The ground below the ring will begin to harden, and a layer of ice will form on the puddles left behind from last night's rain. I urge Crimson forward, feel the lift of each hind leg as he walks. Before going into the ring, we warm up around the outside. Crimson is lazy by nature, but with the wind behind us, he launches into a loose, flowing trot. I give him his head, and he seems to float for an instant above the ground before pushing off with diagonal legs. The cold breeze stings my cheeks, and my eyes water, but I wouldn't give up this feeling for anything. I am 33 years old and have been riding horses since I was 9. From the beginning, I was entranced with their power, their muscled fluidity. I was a typical young girl in love with horses, but there was more, a nuance I couldn't articulate and still struggle to name. Call it a connection, an invisible fiber that runs between me and these four-legged creatures as if we are one and the same. Crimson's large brown eyes, his very skin, seem to absorb every sensation and emotion that passes through me. Standing in the aisle this afternoon, brushing his coppery coat, it was as if he intuited something was different, that I was different. Could he feel the new life growing inside me? The wind howls eerily, and Crimson gives a gentle rolling buck, the kind that shows that while he'll go along with it, he's ambivalent about working. I wish I wasn't, but I'm ambivalent about being pregnant. Having a baby feels like the most incredible gift anyone could ever receive. But I didn't grow up dreaming of being a mother. As the youngest in my family, I hardly spent any time around children younger than me. I was much too self-involved. Now, facing the idea of raising a child scares me. I'm unequipped, and there's so much at stake. What if I don't have any mothering instincts? Or what if, on the other hand, I fall madly in love with this baby? Will I lose myself in the caretaking, as my mother did? Who would I be if I gave up my love of horses and my passion for writing? Joel and I have worked hard, turning our dream of having a farm into reality. We've lived off his salary, saving every check I earned as a magazine and newspaper editor. We own the land, but we still have fencing and a barn to build. Will the vision of bringing Crimson home disappear if I have a baby? And how will Joel and I handle the stress and exhaustion that comes with a newborn? His long hours at work and his travel schedule are already a source of tension between us. I want him to partner with me in raising a child. And last, the thing I'm most concerned about, the thing I don't like to think about, I inherited a chromosomal abnormality from my mother that gives me a 50% chance of having a miscarriage. I could lose this baby.
And what was it that made you combine two difficult topics into one memoir? Isn't it hard enough to write about one?
Yes, and it's funny. I was just thinking, at this point in time, I had no idea that the Alzheimer's was going to come. I was just keeping track of what was going on with my baby-making situation, right. And I was hoping that that was going to move forward. But then, actually, as I was working on the memoir, a friend of mine said, you know, this thing is connected. It's your mother you're losing, and you're trying to be a mother. And these mm-hmm. things are happening at the same time. And that just struck me. And so I thought, there's probably a way to combine those two. So that's what I spent 20 years working on.
And you did have some miscarriages, were you?
I did, yes. Yeah. I had a series of miscarriages.
And so, but now, tell us, you've got...
Now I have a beautiful daughter. She's 17 years old, which
about is about to go to college, right?
Yes.
You've been out. I've seen your Facebook post. You're out looking at colleges.
Yes, yes. It's amazing. And she was just such an incredible gift at a time when life was looking pretty dark. And the end of the memoir does bring her into it, which it was such an amazing thing to happen after experiencing such loss with my mom.
And this honesty that percolates up in all memoir, you see it here in your struggle, which probably many people don't want to say out loud, but a lot of people are feeling that, you know, I want my stuff, I want my writing, I want my horses. I want my, and then, but a baby. And then others might be critical of someone for thinking that. And yet, I'm thinking that that's not an unusual feeling that men and women are having.
That's really nice to hear, Landis, because yeah. I did worry about that. I thought, oh, I am putting myself out there. And particularly, I didn't want my daughter to think that, you know, she was not wanted, because, of course, she was deeply, deeply wanted. But I am a flawed human being with all these feelings.
But I think it's natural. We have children, 32 and 29. And, of course, my wife is, we'd love to have grandchildren at some point. We have to just keep quiet about it, right?
You know? Yes, right.
Because it's a different world now, and there's lots to think about in terms of that. But these thoughts, I'm sure, are going through their heads. And the one thing that I say is, well, you never know until you have a child of your own. And then
yes.
then it's all switches.
It does. It
and
does.
Yet you can have more than just one thing. It's not an either-or proposition, right?
Right.
But you don't know that before you have a child.
You don't. And it was hard for me to balance things, partly because I was helping to care for my mother, and so doing that and then caring for a baby, there really wasn't a lot of time for writing in there, or horses, which all of those things were important to me.
But it gave you more material to write about.
It did. It did.
Well, I think it's, you know, anyone who's writing a memoir, that takes courage to do it, particularly topics of this type. When we come back, Anne is going to take us to a very touching scene near the end of the book. So hang with us. Hey, listeners, believe it or not, this is the 12th and final episode of Season 2. And we've had a great run, a lot of really fine authors in this season. We'd like to bring more authors to you in Season 3. You can help us do that by doing a few simple things, and it won't cost you a cent. We'd love it if you'd go to Apple Podcast and leave a review about the show or about a particular episode. Leaving a review at Apple Podcast is kind of like putting gasoline in the vehicle that's going to get this message out into the world. You can also go to our website and join our email list. We're not going to spam you, but we'll send you information from time to time about the show, which you can share with others. And if you follow us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and share from time to time information about the show and upcoming episodes, it'll really help get the message out there. Because at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is support authors, let people find out about their work, and listen to what they have to say. In other words, help these authors give voice to their written words. Thanks a lot. Now back to the show with Anne Campanella. All right, Anne, we are at a point later in the book, and I'd like you to read this scene because as I read it, I got a little emotional listening, you know, as I was reading it. Mm-hmm. Sensing this very personal situation between you and your mother. So how about reading this?
Sure. Do you want me to set it up a little bit?
Sure, go ahead and set it up. That'd be great.
My family and I had brought my mother to upstate New York to her family summer home. And this was her last trip there. Mm-hmm. And we made a huge effort to do that. We even brought two aides from her rest home so that her sort of living situation would be normal and not disrupted. And my uncle her younger brother had happened to pass away about 2 weeks before this time. And we almost scrapped the trip, but then we decided, let's go ahead and have it. And he actually spent his summers up at Lake George, which is where we were. And right before this scene, we had had a family picnic dinner just outside on the picnic table, and lots of family members had been there, cousins, and lots of stuff flying, and my mother could really barely keep up with what was going on. And the aides took her to put her to bed, and I go in and check on her because the aides are like, your mom is not going to sleep. We need some help here. Mom, I'm here now. Please talk to me. Sitting on the edge of the bed, I brush strands of pale hair away from her forehead. Lines crease the skin of her brow. You don't even treat me like I'm a real person, she says. I think about dinner, how I played the part of hostess, talking to each cousin, making each of them feel comfortable, yet I spent very little energy on her. I didn't try to slow the pace of the conversation or look at her with encouragement. I took over her role in her environment at her house at Lake George. If she'd been in her normal state of mind, she would have been happy, proud, maybe even a little in awe of the way I could perform in a large group, jumping from corporate matters to personal conversation, talking to and connecting with each person. But she is far from her normal state of mind tonight. Rubbing the skin of her forearm lightly, the way she did with me when I was a child, I run through the tips for dealing with people who have Alzheimer's. But they don't seem useful tonight. My mother doesn't seem out of her mind, just angry, and maybe for good reason. It's been a hard time, hasn't it? I don't want to mention my uncle's death specifically in case it upsets her. The babies I have lost, my mother's grandchildren, float through my mind. Yes, I guess it has. Her voice is steely. Thank you for at least not trying to act like everything is okay. She is still angry, and I wonder if the aides have repeatedly told her, everything's okay, when she knew darn well that it wasn't. Daddy comes into the room. He slips out of his pants and shirt and sits on the other side of the bed. Would you slide over a little bit, Bet? No, I won't. My father proceeds to fit his large body around hers, grunting as he moves. He tries to squeeze his right arm under Mom, but gives up when she doesn't adjust her neck to let him in. He finally turns over, pressing his back into her. His bent knees fall over the edge of the bed. For the next few minutes, strange noises come from him, a series of burps, farts, and groans. Is this normal? I ask Mom. How do you sleep? I'm hoping this disruption will take her mind off her anger, maybe even make her laugh. No one suffers like your father does. Her voice is still cool, and she seems remarkably focused. Mom, I'm so sorry if I've done something to upset you. If you've done something? Her eyes fly open as if this is a ridiculous question. I guess I've been insensitive to your feelings. There's been so much going on around here. I know that's no excuse. It's just been hard for me to keep up with everything. I'm really worn out. I'm sure you're exhausted, too. I guess I am. She sniffles. Mom, you have no idea how special you are. I lean over and kiss her on the cheek. I am? I don't feel special. She sounds like a little girl. I pull a tissue from the box on her dresser and dab at her eyes. She has needed someone to reach out to her, someone to wade into the dark waters of her disease and stretch out a hand. I've stood on the shore all of my life, even before she was ill, afraid to walk toward her, afraid of her next move. It was safer to stand at a distance, pick apart her behavior, try to diagnose her symptoms. How lonely it must be for her, stranded within her own mind. You've taught me so many things. How important it is to be sensitive. I don't know what I'd do without you. My own eyes fill with tears. I pull another tissue from the box. Oh, look what I've done. Now you're upset too. I didn't mean to do that. Mom sniffles again, and I lean down and press my forehead to hers. It is cool and slightly damp, the texture of rose petals. It's okay, Mom. I think it's good for me to cry. For both of us to cry. We've been through a lot. I think of my miscarriages, my mother's hospitalization, the hurricane, my mother's seizure, my time away from Joel, so many difficult things. But we are here together, sharing our grief. You've given me a lot of joy, having you as a daughter. For the first time, I'm sure Mom knows it's me sitting on the bed. Her voice sounds soothing and normal. It's a gift I remember from long ago when I was a child. It's a moment of clarity, an unexpected gift. I've been blessed to have you as a mother. Thanks for trying to understand me. Mom opens her eyes and smiles. Her words stay in my head. I think of her strange phrases, her agitation. Was it all a code, a message she was trying to send to the people she loved? A message that said, I'm still here, I need you.
And that sounds like a piece that you did have a vivid memory of.
I did.
And that, there's so much to talk about in what you just read here, but you mentioned thinking about the tips for dealing with people who have Alzheimer's. What are some of those tips?
Some of the tips are go along with them, distract them, talk in a calm voice. And of course, that was something I did do. But there's lots of things that really they're helpful in most situations, or in situations when the person really isn't in their right mind. But it was clear to me in this situation that Mom had this moment of clarity, and she was not about to be distracted from what was going on.
But you weren't sure about her clarity, and you tried these tips, and then it looks like you just fell back into sort of one of the most basic emotions of all, love.
Yes.
And you just let that guide what happened next.
That's a good way to put it. I think I also confessed my own inadequacy,
right,
and the fact that, and my mom was so intuitive. I mean, she could tell from a mile away if I was trying to cover up something. And so it was like, okay, I need to just admit that I have messed up here and I have not really been treating her with the respect and dignity that she deserves.
And that's another thing that I think is difficult, because when you try to do for someone because you think they're struggling, and sometimes they are struggling to do that very thing, yet
yes,
you make them feel less dignified when you do it.
Yes, and that
and
was
something.
That's
a tough balance, right?
Oh, yes, and Mom hated that. She hated when people talked down to her in any way, even if she needed that kind of help. She wanted to be treated like she was a valuable human being. And
one of the things they say is you should try to come closer. That is, you should try to acknowledge that it's okay to be confused. It happens. And I get confused sometimes too.
Yes.
And so I understand. I empathize with where you're coming from.
Yes. And that can be so hard, because so often if they're like in a different time, you want to bring them back to the present time. And you want to say, well, no, you're talking about your father. He died. He's gone. But if you can just stay with them where they are, that does make a huge difference. And that was something I learned over the course of Mom's illness, but I certainly didn't know it all the way through.
Right. And great moment at the end where you both have this connection. And it's not that she's saying you do understand me, because you can't be inside her body, but she thanks you for trying to understand.
Yeah, that brought tears. And as I was writing it, it brought tears again, because it just, we, you know, as mother and daughter, which is probably typical, you know, we had moments of closeness and moments where we didn't understand each other. And I was a bad teenager. And so all of that is, you know, part of our history. But then to have her speak to me in that way was just, it just got to my heart.
All right, so we're going to shift to a little lighter topic here to learn a little bit more about you as a writer. I call this first draft, short exercise. Give you two choices. You can pick one or the other, or neither.
Okay.
Or both.
Okay.
And then tell me why. You ready?
All right. Okay, go.
All right. Ink, pen, or keyboard?
Pencil.
Pencil. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I like pencil because I like to be able to erase, and it just feels less committing.
All right, good. Poetry or prose?
It's got to be both. Yeah. I love them both.
And your memoir did have some lyrical aspects to it.
Yeah, I mean, thank you. And I felt like I treated the memoir as one huge poem. I sort of wanted to create a memoir that would have that kind of quality.
Fiction or nonfiction?
Nonfiction.
Morning or night? When are you best at your writing?
Oh, gosh. I love night, and I used to be a night person, but having become a mother, I would say I've been forced into morning, and I love morning.
Okay. Outline or free flow?
I like to free flow within a little bit of outlining.
Okay, a little combination. Writing or editing?
Well, I love to write, and that uses a certain part of my brain, but I cannot let it go without editing. So I am.
Do you edit as you go, or do you get a draft down and then come back?
Both. I usually can't let it go unless I've edited, even if it's a paragraph.
Okay. Library or Google?
Oh, my gosh, that's so hard because I grew up with my great-great-grandfather built his own library next to his house, and that became my grandmother's home. So I've got to say library.
But you cheat. You go to Google,
I
right?
do cheat, yeah.
Okay. Dictionary or spell check?
That's another one. My mother had a huge dictionary on a table in our house, and I just loved that. And I love dictionaries, and I love words, but now I'm into spell check.
Yeah, yeah. Introvert or extrovert?
Definitely introvert.
Okay. E-reader or paper book?
Definitely paper book, although I am shifting.
Shifting, okay.
I am. Yeah. I now have...
You have an e-reader now?
I do, okay. Yeah. And I like it because it's really nice to carry things on planes and that kind of thing.
Social media or personal appearances?
I like personal appearances if they're few and far between.
That's the introvert speaking.
Yeah. Yes, yes. But I do enjoy doing social media from the privacy of my bedroom.
All right. Marketing or manual labor?
Oh,
you got a horse farm, right? There's some manual.
Yes, I definitely.
And you're at peace when you're working the stalls,
yes,
right?
Yes, I like manual labor.
But maybe you just like to market better.
Well, I love marketing other people.
Okay.
It's really hard to market myself, though. But I do love marketing others.
All right. Well, thanks for that. We've got time for one last piece here. And this, since you are a poet, we're going to have you read a poem at the end. And it's called Hurricane Donna, September 1960. Might have been a time when you were born, right?
Yeah. It happens to be, yeah. Don't tell anybody.
Okay, all right, okay. It comes, I mean, you can see it in the poem, okay?
Yes, I know. And it's out there.
The secret's out.
So, yes, yeah. It is. Hurricane Donna, September 1960. Conceived in the womb of the Sahara, where desert winds rose, she created undulations off the coast of Africa in the fertile season of September. Mother Desert, Father Ocean, a tropical wave, funnel of warm, wet air churned across the Atlantic horse latitudes, turning with the spin of the earth. Mom always said I was born in the middle of a hurricane. Newscasters called her Deadly Donna as the eye curved across Florida. Atmospheric pressure dropping, swollen with child, my mother watched as two huge oaks gusted down on either side of our drive. I never worried, she said. I knew your father could handle it. A blind trust, the kind that blew her from her New York home, toddler in tow, daddy in Korea, to the coast of Washington, where she gave birth to a son, spun them to my father's home state of Florida, where another son was delivered, then me, red and squalling, ricocheted the family to the tropics, then boomeranged us back to a little town on the cusp of North Carolina, where my parents finally dropped anchor, a place where the same storm that birthed me flooded the banks that held back the sea.
What inspired this?
Actually, I had written a collection of poems called The Beach Poems, and I was looking for a poem to begin the collection. And I wanted something that would... the collection, in addition to being The Beach Poems, was about my journey with my mother's Alzheimer's and sort of letting go of the grief and accepting the joy in my life of all she had been. So I wanted a first poem that would sort of introduce my mother and our relationship. And she had always said I was born in the middle of a hurricane, and I think I was a bit of a hurricane in her life.
Conceived in the womb of the Sahara where desert winds rose. I mean, that's a great image of how a hurricane gets started, right?
Yes.
Are we talking about a hurricane? We're talking about a life there.
Yeah. Absolutely. And yeah. I experienced a lot of hurricanes. I grew up until I was 9 in Jacksonville, Florida, and we were constantly, every hurricane season, we were taping the windows and preparing for to watch the anemometer. And then when I moved to Morehead City with my parents as a high schooler, I was amazed to find out that this same hurricane that had cut across Florida when I was born had actually hit Morehead City during, I guess it just went out into the ocean and then came back. And I'm like, wow, we ended up in that same place, and that's where my parents lived out their life.
Wow. Well, Ann, these are great stories and poems you've shared with us today. I want to thank you for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Landis.
Now, where can we find your work? Do you have a website?
I do. It's anncampanella.com.
Okay.
It's in Main Street Books at Davidson, Park Road Books, and Amazon, of course.
Yeah. Anywhere online. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, again, thanks. It was great having you on the show.
Thank you so much. It was a treat.
Well, that's it for today. Another fine author giving voice to her written words. That's also it for season 2. We've had 12 fine authors give voice to their written words. And that brings me to this. We're going to have more. We're going to have a few bonus episodes, and then we'll have a season 3. We hope you'll come back and listen. And in the meantime, if you don't mind, leave that review on Apple Podcasts, and maybe join our email list and follow us on social media. Tell your friends. I'm looking forward to the next episodes. I think you're going to like the authors we've got lined up. Until then, I'm Landis Wade for Charlotte Readers Podcast.